Dead or alive, you are coming with me.
What is this bullshit?
Good trash genre cast.
I love you.
I know.
Wax on, right hand. Wax off, left hand.
Run! Ah! Get to the chopper!
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Hello, everybody, and welcome again to the Good Trash Genre Cast. People gather around a table, and we discuss the films you'll never discuss in a film studies course. We have just wrapped up our Shocktober marathon. And
spooky.
And we are moving into a new marathon, which involves something semi-spooky, a Stephen King adaptation, as we move into Netflix November and Gerald's Game.
Yeah, it turns out Netflix has made all these friggin' movies and then dropped them all right back to back, so there's a bunch we're behind on, and we're gonna watch them for November, and a little soft transition out of the season of the spook, and we're gonna do yet another Mike Flanagan joint with his adaptation of Gerald's Game, which just hit Netflix four or five weeks ago. Yeah.
And as you all know, the film Gerald's Game is about a young college student named Gerald who's trying to develop some game in picking up girls.
See, I assumed it sounds more like a golf movie to me.
Directed by Spike Lee.
God, if only.
Or maybe something else. Now, let's go ahead and identify the voices speaking to your brain if you're tuning into the Good Trash Undercast for the first time from the Good Trash Media Network. Who are you there in recliner, sir?
I am Arthur Gordon, and Dalton's 5 inches say hello.
They do too often. To my left, sir, who are you?
My name is Dalton Stewart, and what is a Dustin if not a life support system for a podcast?
Oh, my goodness. And
that's from the half court, Mark, baby.
Oh, my name is Dustin Sells, and those go for $200 a serving, and I'm so glad to be here with you all talking Gerald's Game. I guess I'm
brought to you by Hulu.
Hey, we got to laugh about something because it's about to get
Hulu.
Oh my God! Thank you for that. Netflix November brought to you by Hulu. Hulu, we keep snatching up all the things that Netflix is allowing the streaming rights to expire on. Want to watch Futurama? Don't need that Netflix subscription anymore.
Go on to Hulu.
So. Yeah, let's. We got to laugh about something because it's about to get real dark.
There's not going to be much laughter or levity here in a few minutes. But if you are tuning into the Good Trash Genrecast for the very first time, we need to warn you as to what is going to happen next.
What's
going to
happen next, Dustin?
What's going to happen next is I'm going to pull out a pair of handcuffs.
Uh-oh.
Wait.
Whoa, oh, no.
The stray Plutos running around the house is going to have some fun tonight.
And then I'm going to pull out another pair of handcuffs. Mm. And then you're going to tell me about where you got that slip. No, what is actually going to happen is we are going to have some spoilers in the course of this show, but we're going to try to
right before they close their doors.
At the first hand, the reason
we're just talking over them.
I'm just going to keep going.
Okay.
The reason why we're going to have spoilers is because this is an analysis show, not a review
show.
That
is true.
Thus and therefore, spoilers will be necessary, but we will avoid them for the first part of the show. We'll have a synopsis from the voice of the cinema as we hear from his golden pipes, and then we will move from that into our quick thumbs up, thumbs down reviews, which will be spoiler-free. Then we will move into our game, which may or may not involve minor spoilers of this film and other films in its orbit. Then we will get down to business. And once business time rolls around, there'll be a kicky musical cue to let you know that that's about to happen. And all spoiler bets are off. You have been warned.
He did such a good job. I mean, he's a real professional.
He's got it down.
He's just a consummate professional despite our constant distractions.
He could do it in his sleep.
I believe. Do you do this in your sleep?
I always do this in my sleep.
I'm sure your kids must love that. Dad, shut up. Go to bed.
I'm sleeping right now, in fact. Anyway, we're going to move on now. Let's hear that synopsis from one Mr. Arthur Gordon, voice of the cinema, if you would, sir.
Following a rousing game of Jenga.
No! Get out of here!
Parcheesi.
You stop that!
While trying to spice up their marriage in their remote lake house, Jessie must fight to survive when her husband dies unexpectedly, leaving her handcuffed to their bed frame.
Yeah, that's, man, just one of those things where you did not plan for all possible eventualities.
There was no redundancy for that, was there?
Oh, man, just, yeah, fail.
There's Denzel when you need him.
Yeah, I mean, if either one of these two had been in the scouts, we'd be fine. But no one was prepared for anything going wrong.
When you fail to plan, you plan to fail, guys. And that is exactly what happens here.
So, we got ourselves a real 127 arrow scenario here.
Man. Ooh. So, yeah, that's a good pair, actually. Yeah. Well done. So without any further ado, Mr. Dalton Stewart, let's hear your quick thumbs up, thumbs down review of the film adaptation of 2017, Gerald's Game.
Yeah, I don't love it as much as the Flanagan movie we watched last week, Hush. I think Hush is just the strength of the cat and mouse game happening in that film really propels it. This is obviously a much more psychological, much more think. I guess I should say
better words might be in order.
Yeah, certainly not thinky. it takes its time.
Cerebral.
There we go. Thank you, Dustin. I was having a really hard time thinking of the right word. Cerebral is the perfect word, actually, because the thrills of Hush are much more visceral and heart-pounding, whereas the thrills of Gerald's Game are deeply upsetting, and not just you know, some trauma stuff we'll talk about later, but really the central premise is quite horrifying. The confined space is quite nauseating. Now, again, while I say I don't like it as much as I like Hush, I do think it's very strong. I think it gets right basically everything Saw gets wrong. It's interesting that we're talking about this just a few weeks after we did the original Saw for our Shocktober marathon. I would be shocked to learn that Lee Whannell was not inspired by this short story by Stephen King, or I should say novella?
No, it's a novel.
It's a full-length novel?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. I would be shocked to learn if Lee Whannell was not inspired by the novel Gerald's Game when writing Saw, because the similarities are there. And I think everything that makes Gerald's Game is the things that Saw adds. The killer makes it less interesting. The remote location makes it less interesting. The being isolated and so in danger and far from safety in a place that is, you know, supposed to be yours. You know, this cabin is not one that they rent. This is a cabin that they own. So the danger feels much more palpable and real. That removal of power in a situation where you're supposed to be safe, I think, really takes things up a notch. And again, we got to talk about the performances because they really carry this film. Carla Gugino is the lead as Jessie, and she is absolutely astonishing. She gets to do, she does what she does better than a lot of other people who try to do it. And Bruce Greenwood is absolutely fantastic. Both of them are, I mean, they really is just a two-hander. And I think they're both really quite remarkable in it. And I think that is really the strength of the film is their performances. What Flanagan chooses to do, I've never read the novel, but my understanding is it is all very internal. The yes. way he chooses to externalize the conversations and conflicts in the film, I think are really, really interesting. It makes me curious about how certain things are executed in the novel because they seem to make so much sense the way they're executed on screen. But overall, and there's some things that I want to talk about that are more spoilery that don't really work for me, but I guess we'll do that when we get to analysis. Overall, for me, it's a very strong Netflix film. It's right mid-level what they typically do, and I'm totally fine with it.
All righty. Well, thank you very much for that, Mr. Dalton Stewart. Mr. Arthur Gordon, what say you in terms of your thumbs up, thumbs down review?
I'm going to agree with Dalton. I do think it is more of a mixed bag than, say, Hush. I like a lot about it. The performances are great. I mean, this movie lives and dies on its performances, I think. And the sequences between Bruce Greenwood and Carla Gugino are extremely strong. They're both just doing great work. I think it flows. It's got a great pace considering the situation of putting, you know, just two people in one room. It works. It runs really well, I think. I think there's a lot lost in some of the dialogue and some of the scripting in the flashback sequences that occurred. The performances there are a lot weaker, I think. And it may just be I'm trying not to compare it with the book, which I didn't get to finish. But I read about 2/3 of.
I read it years and years ago myself.
Yeah, I'm trying not to compare it with that. But this it I feel like there's a bit of a rush that happens, and there's some temporal stuff that gets lost. They make mention of how much time has passed, but it doesn't really feel like it's been that long in certain sequences, you know. And so that kind of stuff is a little confusing. But you're right. The way he decides to externalize that internal dialogue, which really drives the book, it works. And I like how that's all takes place. And like you said, it's, oh man, being stuck somewhere, you know.
Yeah, man.
And that's the harder part, I think, about that. You know, it's to get trapped in somewhere that's unfamiliar. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's scary. But to be trapped in your home, I think is, you know, tenfold worse than that.
Yeah, I feel like it's a much more palpable terror.
Yeah. And so I jury is still out, I think, as far as much I like this. I think it's a real mixed bag, though. But, you know, it's you own it if you have Netflix, and so it's not like it's costing you anything extra if you do, you know, sit down to watch it. So I'm probably slightly leaning positive on it for the most part. I think it has more working good for it than it has against it. So,
all right, fair enough. I have to say, in terms of my review, that I really, really like this movie, and I think the first two acts are amazing. Absolutely, really, really solid, amazing, excellent psychological horror. The way in which they are doing the work of adaptation to have what's going on inside Jesse's head. I mean, all the things that we said, I think it's very well shot. I think in some ways Mike Flanagan is sort of channeling the ghost of Jonathan Demme throughout the film with those close-ups.
Okay. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And so
there's some great close-ups of both of them.
Yeah. And so the lighting's a little bit different, but I like what they're doing with that. And I still really am impressed with it. The Moonlight Man or the Space Cowboy is absolutely terrifying, which is the giant from Twin Peaks, as we all, or the fireman is what his name is, but the giant from the Twin Peaks. And I think that's terrifying. I think it's maybe the best Stephen King adaptation of 2017, is what I might suggest. Because I think it is of a sort of horror that sticks with you, mm-hmm. as opposed to sort of jumpy, kind of scary kind of stuff. I'm looking at you. It is what I'm looking at right now, which is not bad. I'm not saying it's bad, but I think this is a better adaptation. I think it's a better Stephen King film than even that. But we'll see what ends up happening with it and its sequel. Because okay. I don't think its horrors stick with you the way the horrors that are going inside Jesse's mind, the horrors of the images of the Moonlight Man.
Let's put a pin in this because I'd like to talk about it at the end of the show.
Okay, well, we'll hold on. But I, for my money, really, really works. I don't like the third act very much. It's a bit too clunky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of voiceover. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got to do some of it because we do have to sort of wrap up some of the story and figure out what's going on
and
with
various
characters, and I'm going to avoid spoilers. But
yeah, that might be what holds me back from liking it as much as you do, Dustin, is I just really dislike the third act that
much. I agree.
Much.
Well, I think it's a little long. I think they do need to wrap up those ends. I think we still need to have.
I agree. I just the execution's.
I think there's a certain spot where I would have ended it.
Yeah, I mean, because once
and I don't think you need some of those answers at the end.
Once the game has been played, we shall say to avoid spoilers.
Yeah,
and it has reached its sudden stop. Once that has all occurred, then really the movie can be over.
Yeah,
but you could have again. Flashes. I mean, there are ways to do a sort of a slower denouement.
Yeah.
You know, this felt very. It felt like Lord of the Rings: Return of the King. Honestly, you know, it just five endings. It kind of just kept going.
A couple of full stops
and lots and lots of hard voiceover in order to get it done. And I was not uber keen on that. It wasn't terrible. But it wasn't nearly as good as what we'd seen up until that point.
That second act is really quite strong.
Oh my goodness! It is one of the most terrifying, horrifying second acts I've seen in a long time. It's a strong film, you know, in that regard. And the first act is super, super short, just a setup, and you know, gets the game going, and then we're gone. So anyway, those are my thoughts about the film. I think all of our biases are generally pro, with some quibbles here and there, and we will certainly quibble one to another, I'm certain, once we get down to some analysis. But we're having this conversation way late at night, unlike we normally do in an afternoon when we're having this conversation. We're doing so not just because we like to talk to each other about films. We're doing so because we want to talk to you, Dalton, can you tell the dear listener how they can talk to us about this conversation?
I suppose I could. Yeah, much like Jesse to a bed, Arthur and I always have our phones on us, shackled forever to the ether of the internet. And if you want to talk to Arthur or I, you can do that. Because we're the ones manning them social medias. You can find us on Twitter.
Because I don't
want
to talk to you.
Yeah, no, Dustin does not want to talk to you. We'll relay anything you have to say to him, and he'll probably roll his eyes. But if you want to have your, if you want to be have eyes rolled at you, you can find us on Twitter at @good_trash, and you can find us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/GTM for Good Trash Media. And as always, you can find everything that we do over on goodtrashmedia.com. Last but certainly not least, we would greatly appreciate it if you're so inclined. Subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, wherever, however you put this in your ear. Do the things over there.
All right. Well, there you go. I've got my handcuffs out. I think it's time to play the game.
No, I don't want to.
Time to play the game. Time to play the game.
Alrighty, well, everybody comfortable?
Well, Dustin, yeah. Dustin now has me bound up Hannibal Lecter style.
I gotta take my pill. I'll be right back.
No. Guys, I don't like being on this person dolly. I don't care for it.
So, this week's game is not going to be that. This film was a novel by Stephen King, and so our game this week is favorite film adaptations.
That's right, favorite film adaptations of literary works, brought to you by Harold's Game. Harold's Game. We didn't decide to limit it to Stephen King adaptations, mostly because a lot of those aren't particularly good, but maybe some of them will make an appearance.
All right. Harold?
Harold?
Yeah, I thought, like, Harold. I don't know.
Harold?
I was having fun.
Geraldo's game?
Geraldo's game. Oh, I don't like that game.
I don't want
to. I've seen those
There's
pictures.
A bunch of empty tombs.
Have you seen the pictures of Geraldo's game? I have.
Oh, I have as well.
They cannot be unseen.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you what, doesn't look as good as Bruce Greenwood.
I am not going to be killed by his 5 inches either. We're going to move.
That mustache might do it, though.
Oh, gosh.
It is all-consuming.
5 inches of mustache.
Much like the Dark Lord Cthulhu, that mustache consumes all.
That'll be the name of my memoir.
5 inches of mustache?
Yeah. Oh.
We're having fun.
We are having fun because we must, because it's about to get heavy, y'all. So let's play some game stuff for fun times. Mr. Arthur Gordon, what's your first selection for favorite film adaptation?
I don't know about everybody else, but I actually went with books I'd read and the movies.
Oh, nice.
Just to kind of
same
add some.
I don't read.
Yeah, I know. Audiobooks, though. I mean, there's that.
That's true.
The first one, though, I'm going to make mention of is a solid one. It takes some deviations from the source material, but it's Jurassic Park. I think both the book and the movie do a really good job of presenting this kind of futuristic science experiment. But I think the movie just, it's a great adaptation, I think, of Crichton's ideas. And it just puts such a fun, vivid world on screen, and I greatly appreciated that. And so I think my first picks are going to go to Jurassic Park.
What a good option. I'm realizing with that pick and some of my picks, I feel like a lot of adaptations are going to have been things we've talked about on the show before. I'm getting the feeling.
Yeah, it's very likely. I would say with Jurassic Park especially, it is a case in which the film is much better than the book. The book is very good.
Yes.
But the film is much leaner and for good reason.
Yeah.
And I do like the flopping of the ages of the kids and some of those other choices.
And
well,
I'll tell you what, no Goldblum.
Yeah, you don't have Goldblum in the book. That's sad.
Yeah, no Goldblum.
No, yeah,
and they spared no expense.
They spared no expense. So there is that as well. All right, Mr. Dalton Stewart, what is your next selection for your first selection, your next in the list of humans of first selection?
It's getting late and he's getting old.
It's okay. I know what he's... I was going to let him get it out.
Just say the things.
Well, my first pick, it's something that comes up on the show so often. It really feels like a joint pick. It really feels like a good trash sponsored pick. It's Silence of the Lambs.
Yes.
The Jonathan Demme film. Demme's already come out once this evening. It's just such a great film.
Yes.
It's such a great thriller, and I think kind of the epitome of what we like to do on this show.
Silence of the Lambs, brought to you by the Good Trash Honorcast and Tyson Foods.
Because it's a much beloved film. I think it's a very appreciated film. I don't know that you're going to see it jump up a whole lot in really serious analytical discourse. I mean, maybe a little bit. Maybe if you're talking about Demme specifically, or you know, the early 90s. Or maybe horror, just because it's one of the only, quote, and again, it's really more of a thriller than a horror film. It has horror elements, And it's the only one I can think of that's won a Best Picture award. So it's going to come up maybe in that regard. But I really feel like it's decidedly top tier Friday night popcorn movie. It is decidedly the upper echelon of middle brow. And I think that's what makes it so, its pleasure so great, and why it's been so endearing throughout the years, or enduring throughout the years, because it has, I mean, yeah, Manhunter came first, but Manhunter didn't exactly set the world on fire quite the way that this adaptation of the Thomas Harris novel did. So I love it to pieces. We've talked about it hundreds of times at this point on the show, so I just want to give it some more love.
Absolutely, and that's another case in which I think the movie is actually better than the book. The book is, it's just like this pot-boiling kind of pulpy kind of novel, you know, about a serial killer, and sort of the standard sort of airport fiction that you might pick up. Also, it does sprawl out in weird places. Do you know the strange bug guy with the strange eye?
Yeah.
You know, him and Clary's end up boning at the end of the novel.
I don't like that.
I don't care for that a little bit.
They end up together, yeah. And yeah, she is seeking solace in his arms after the entire you know, crazy ordeal that she has gone through. And I'm glad to have that left out. So there is that. So I'm going to move on to my pick, my first of the picks for the night, which is Peter Benchley's Jaws, adapted into Steven Spielberg's Jaws. So Spielberg, once again, taking kind of bad books and making them into pretty great movies.
And yet another film we've talked about on the show.
And we have talked about on the show. It's a nearly perfect movie, really. And the way it's paced and everything else. And again, there's some weird flops in character and places in the novel that the film changes, and I like that. It ends up being that Hooper sleeps with Brody's wife, and he is the one who's killed by the shark while they're out on their little fishing expedition. And that switch is a good idea and a good choice. Several other choices. And
clearly, it makes more sense for me to die dramatically.
There's a lot of sex. There's a scene in which Brody is talking. Not Brody. Excuse me.
It was a terrible quint.
But, sorry. Hooper's talking dirty to Brody's wife in a restaurant because they're old friends, or they're friends of old friends from college or whatever. And it's graphic.
Yeah, I've heard. I've heard tale of these things.
You know, I'm just not a fan.
I just wanted to point out that, bad impression aside, it makes way more sense for Quint to die.
Yeah.
Just dramatically, it makes infinitely more sense. Benchley, what do you think, buddy? Come on.
But anyway, okay, so there you go. The first round of picks is done. The next round is next. That's how next works. So, Mr. Arthur Gordon, what is your second selection of your favorite film adaptations?
My second round draft pick is going to go to another Stephen King adaptation, and it is The Mist. I greatly appreciate the movie. I like the book quite,
hey,
or the novella.
We'll just go ahead and skip right into it. This is my second pick as well.
I don't like that. I don't like you.
No, it's too bad.
Don't steal my thunder.
We have similar tastes.
Don't steal my thunder.
No, we like the same things.
I think it's such a great adaptation. I really do. I think it upholds the spirit of the story. And it is a novella. It's in Skeleton Crew. And I think it upholds a lot of what he's doing. And Stephen King's great about, you know, developing these characters and sticking them in an event. You know, Under the Dome is another one. Where we have people trapped and we see, you know, how civilization kind of plays out in those situations and who comes to power and how that all works out. And I think Marcia Gay Harden, I believe, is in The Mist, and
she
does a great job.
She's so good.
You hate her, and she's so great. And Thomas Jane is super solid. I know a lot of people are kind of hit or miss on the ending. I appreciate the ending. I mean, and I don't know if I love the stinger there, but I do think that they're, you know, trapped in a world without hope. What else do you do? You know? And so I love it. I had a memorable experience watching that movie. And so I think it's a rock solid adaptation as an adaptation, you know, speaking, you know, quality of movie, I think it's really good, but as an adaptation, I think it works very well in upholding the spirit of the novella.
All right, so number one and or number two and number two for both of you.
Yeah, no, I absolutely, I'm right there with Arthur. Again, I have not read the novella, but I love it. I love that ending. I love how awful it is. I know that there's some people I know that really, really hate that ending, but I think it works absolutely well. I think Thomas Jane sells it. It goes maybe a little too big, but I like Thomas Jane, and I love Andre Bauer in it.
Oh, yeah.
Mercer Gay Harden, who we've already mentioned, is absolutely astonishing. And the creature design is really fun.
Oh, yeah.
It's really gross and squishy.
Yep.
I think it's fun and spooky, and Does all the fun things that, you know, a really top-tier zombie story do without the baggage of having zombies in it, because they're kind of old hat at this point, unfortunately. I mean, you can definitely see why AMC wanted Frank Darabont to be the showrunner of The Walking Dead. And obviously, that relationship fell apart, but you see why, because he has a handle on, you know, showing these relationships as dynamic, easily perverted and easily corrupted things. So he's a real eye for how those situations play out on screen. So you can see why he got that job. And this film is definitely stronger than the season and a half of television that he would eventually showrun, I think.
All righty. Well, my number two pick is not The Mist. It is Roderick Thorpe's novel, Nothing Lasts Forever. Which you might know better.
Oh, I know it better.
Yeah, you might know better as the film Die Hard.
You're damn right I do.
And which is another case of a superior film to the novel in question. It's a sequel to a film, another novel called The Detective, in which there was an adaptation made starring Frank Sinatra back in the day. But, golly, I'm Die Hard, guys.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, it is a perfect action film.
Another thing we've talked about on the show. I don't recommend people go back and listen to that one, though.
That's pretty good.
It's okay.
Is it? The
quality's not great, but, yeah. I mean, production
sound quality.
Sound
quality, yeah. But, no, Arthur's, Arthur's content is pretty baller.
Oh, Arthur's content was absolutely fabulous.
Yeah.
No, that was purely a sound thing, and that was back in the Wild West. Anybody could come on the show anytime they wanted, days,
yep.
Which means
yeah.
things got a little messy from
but
time
Arthur
to time.
Arthur had some game that day.
Man, you really did. I feel like we all had some fun things. I went back in when we were doing the digital guide for the Patreon. I went back and listened to part of that one, and dear God, I was not pleased with myself.
You live, you learn, you grow.
Yeah.
Some of us, anyway.
Nothing lasts forever, it turns out. So, moving right along.
God, thank God.
Mr. Arthur Gordon, what is your number one draft pick for favorite film adaptation?
This one has came up on the show before as part of a larger thing that we did once, but it is The Prisoner of Azkaban. I think Alfonso Cuarón walked in and he adapted a film that really matched what The Prisoner of Azkaban book does, because it bridges that gap. It takes it from this lighthearted kind of entry into this magical world, and it adds that dark twist to it. And I think Cuarón was the perfect director to come in and do that on film. I think it matches the spirit. It's to this day, it's in the top three of the Harry Potter adaptations, I think. I think it's just great. And I think it works very well. It moves really well, and it really does a good job of holding up that imagery and that tone from the book, which is so key. It's kind of a flux moment for that series, and I think that the movie matches that, tit for tat. And I think it is just a beautiful example of an adaptation that works very well.
I totally agree. Thank you very much for that. Mr. Arthur Gordon, what is your number one pick, Mr. Dalton Stewart?
My number one pick is the Coen Brothers adaptation of Cormac McCarthy's No Country for Old Men.
Nice.
It's one of those movies that I like. Every time I revisit it, I go into it thinking, you're going to like this less than the last time you watched it. It's one of those films, because, you know, it came out at a time that I was really kind of the target. I wasn't the target demo, but I was just like ripe for falling in love with it. I was 17. I was like really getting into film, and it gave me all the visceral genre thrills that I mean, to this day still really speak to me on a very, very serious level. But it presented me with really bleak and complicated. I shouldn't even say complicated, just dire philosophical implications. That you know, those genre trappings, I wasn't used to seeing those things paired together. So it really hit me the first time I saw it, and every time I revisit it, I expect you're going to like it less. You know, you're older, you like different things now, and it still hits me right where I live every time I watch it. I just think it's, speaking of cat and mouse games, with my first pick of Silence of the Lambs, the story of Llewellyn Moss versus Anton Chigurh is really compelling to me. I love the drama of the hunted and hunter dynamic they have, and Tommy Lee Jones is the sheriff trying to make sense of all of this madness. His world weariness is just, I mean, he's peak Tommy Lee Jones. But again, every time I think, surely there's nothing left for this film to offer me, I find something about it that's really special and shiny, and didn't really appreciate the last time I had watched it. So despite my best intentions, it remains one of my favorite film adaptations.
All righty. Well, thank you very much for that, Mr. Dalton. I like that movie a lot myself. My last selection is an adaptation that's gone through two levels of adaptation. I'm talking about Victor Hugo's sprawling novel, Les Miserables, adapted to a musical, adapted to a film in 2012 by Tom Hooper, starring Jor-El and Wolverine and Catwoman.
Wait, and do you really like this movie?
I love that movie.
No,
I absolutely love that movie.
I think you're the only one, but I love that you love it.
I love the novel, and yeah. I have seen really, really faithful adaptations of the novel, and they're usually like 6 hour long, 2 part, 3 hour films,
yeah.
And it's just too much. What I love about it is that it takes the best of the musical and makes sure that we work all that sing and song and dance stuff that I think is really kind of great. The twirling barricades and all the sort of stuff that they put together for the Broadway play is a great bit of spectacle. And they're able to integrate those sort of things. Tom Hooper is and his production staff are able to integrate those things alongside with the main thematic character beats of the story of Jean Valjean and Javert and Fantine. And it really is powerful. And I'm really moved by that film. And I know it's schmaltzy, and I know it's, you know, maybe surprising. But
no, I like that you like it. Like I said,
I like that movie a lot. I bought it on Blu-ray as soon as it came out.
Wow.
Yeah, I really, really dig it.
You never cease to astonish.
I like
man of multitudes.
I like Les Mis a lot. My favorite adaptation's a musical.
What's your favorite song?
My favorite is the Look Down song.
What's the Look Down song?
Look down. You'll always be a slave.
Thank you, Arthur.
Which was a joke in our house because we were doing one of our Arnold things on the show at one point.
Get down, yeah.
And so it's get down, you'll always be a slave. It was very
You really could just mess with the lyrics all the way through.
It's good times.
Yeah.
Yeah. But nonetheless, that's one of my favorites. Shocking, I guess. Dear listener, we'd love to hear your favorite film adaptations. There's a lot of things that we love that we didn't talk about. We didn't talk about The Shining. We didn't talk about any number of things that we like a lot.
Yeah, there's tons. I mean, I'm sure we all did the same thing. It took a cursory glance of, all right, let's look at a bunch of adaptations and go, oh, I love these three.
Yeah, and try to pick something different. I did, at least. You guys obviously just...
I didn't expect him to pick The Mist. I really didn't.
I didn't expect to pick The Mist, but I saw it and I was like, oh, shit, yeah. Yeah, I'm surprised that doesn't happen. We usually do a pretty good job of not having any repeats on the show, but
Honorable mention goes to Lawrence Fishburne's Othello.
No, you don't get an honorable. No, we can't give him crap for getting an honorable mention.
Oh,
you
okay.
Get one.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah,
but again, there.
I mean, if we're going to give out honorable mentions, we got to throw out. The Green Mile.
Look what I started. Oh, yeah. Green Mile.
Ran by Kira Kurosawa of King Lear. I mean, yeah, well, there's lots of great things out there. So, dear listener, we'd love to hear from
Lion
you.
King as
Lion
Hamlet.
Lion King as Hamlet, yeah. Yes. So, many, many things. We'd love to hear from you all.
I'm a big fan of the Hamlet with Ethan Hawke.
I am a big fan of transitions. And now we are going to move on and get down to business. Alrighty, and now Tobin Bell is with us, and he would like to play a game. And we are going to play the game of analysis of Gerald's game. The last joke of the night, probably, guys.
And I really kind of want to see Tobin Bell in the Bruce Greenwood spot now.
Dear God.
How good does Bruce Greenwood look?
My word.
I'm actually, as an adaptation thing, I'm really upset about it because Gerald looks nothing like that.
Oh, is Gerald supposed to be?
Gerald's like a pot-bellied, overweight, red-faced Danny DeVito type.
His attraction is with his money.
I really enjoyed getting to see Bruce Greenwood's rockin' bod.
Six-pack.
Oh, God. What in the world is he eating? How is that possible?
Nothing but steak.
Jesus.
Just probably cut from mastodons.
Just mastodons and asparagus. That's it. My word.
Yeah,
what a beautiful man.
Brother's looking good. So let's talk about the third act and the adaptation question.
Something popped into my head briefly before we get into that. Do you feel like how handsome Bruce Greenwood is? Because that is a specific choice.
Oh, yeah.
To go ahead and make him sexy as hell. Yeah. What do you think that does for the menace of Gerald? Do you think it makes him scarier? Do you think it makes him more harder to gauge as a person?
I think he's harder to gauge from just he's in the book. He's, you know, he's a lot more aggressive up front. We know a lot more of her internal dialogue.
There's a little more ambiguity with the film than there is in the novel.
Because they make him sympathetic, right? When we go
a little bit.
When he goes outside, he's like, oh, you've got a sweetheart. You know, he's very kind to her. In the book, that's not really... I mean, in the book, it
he's
starts and they're in bed.
He's much more outright
lecherous. Right. And yeah, it's a lot quicker because we're already in her head, so we already know what she's kind of thinking, that she's kind of already regretting these ideas, and she's not really into it anymore. And the movies, you know, this is kind of the first time they've really done this.
Mm-hmm.
And the book, they've, you know, gone through it a few times. So I don't know that it. I feel like, yeah, it's one of those things where he seems like he's more caught up in the moment than he is, and those frustrations start to come out rather than in the book. He's just kind of a total, kind of gross,
ew,
kind of thing. And so yeah, I think Greenwood being attractive kind of dulls the knife a little bit.
For me, I don't know if it makes much difference because in the end, he still becomes a predatory man who uses his advantages to take advantage over a woman. And the fact that it's a good-looking guy doesn't really make much difference because this is what an ugly guy would do as well, you know. And so, I mean, the point is his predatory nature and the looks themselves. They're sort of incidental, but I guess there might be an argument made that, you know, even guys who could probably get some, right, on their own, you know, find, you know, piece of chicken on the side to provide that particular bit of need that the man may have. Even those guys can be predatory monsters. I guess there's a usefulness there. But in the end, his looks are sort of indifferent to me.
See, I like this because for Arthur, it dulls the knife. For you, it doesn't do anything. And for me, I think it makes the critique that much sharper, or the point sharper, I should say. Because what you just said, I think it does decidedly make it more about power than sex, which it, at the end of the day, it is about power. Which, and again, I think I'm so used to seeing Bruce Greenwood in very kind of righteous paternal roles, and I think the casting against type does a lot in the film's favor. Not only am I not used to seeing Bruce Greenwood as a sexual object, and well, God, I've been missing out, but I'm not used to seeing him be a bad guy. And it, even though you know, it lets you know pretty quick that Gerald, whether we're talking about, and we should go ahead and clarify in case you decide not to watch the movie. Bruce Greenwood's appearing as a figment of Jesse's imagination for the entirety of the film, pretty much.
Yeah, after the last, like, 15 first, minutes.
Yeah, he eats it very early. So, again, this is all her internal monologue of how she saw Gerald. And Bruce Greenwood playing her internal monologue reminds her, hey, this is what you thought about me.
Yeah.
So, and I, you know, I wasn't honest with you, and you figured this much out, so clearly you were lying to yourself about something. But again, I think having him be super attractive is kind of an interesting choice. I was just curious about that before we go into that third act.
Well, yeah, the third act and the question of adaptation for 2017. We have Stephen King's It being adapted, which was a massive success. It's like the only Hollywood film that made any money this year for the most part. I mean, we've got Thor coming.
And your Spider-Mans.
And your Spider-Mans. And yeah. So, I mean, it's really the rare instance of Hollywood doing well because we've, like, post-September 11 numbers right now for cinema attendance. So it did very, very well. But I do think this is a better adaptation than Stephen King's It.
I would say that, spoiler alerts for Stephen King's 2017 It, they both struggle from third act problems because, you know, in the third act of It, it is taking one of the most interesting and well-developed characters, Bev, and having her be a damsel in distress, which is very different from
big
her
mistake.
Role in the novel. Yeah, it's a huge mistake. For me, it's one of only a handful of huge missteps in the film overall. But I think it's a big mistake. Here, I think the third act problems are much bigger. They're structural.
Yeah.
There is a lack of structural integrity with it. For me, it's, well, the framing's not great, but the picture's good. It's just how we get there is kind of, yeah. What we even do in the third act of this film, it just feels like a big misstep. And let's go ahead and get directly into it. Dustin, do you want to?
Well, I would say this first before I get it. I do find that the horrors that Jesse faces to be much more unnerving and terrifying In terms of, you know, the psychological history, and we'll get to that later, which is huge and massive. And of course, there is also some layers of psychological history in Stephen King's It. But I think it's better treated in Gerald's Game.
I would agree with that as well.
And I think the overall imagery of the Moonlight Man as a monster is far more frightening than Pennywise the Clown by Bill Skarsgård.
I think that the third act cuts it out, though.
Yeah, do you really?
I think putting the light completely on him.
Same.
Kills that imagery.
What I also think that for me, it is such an emotionally powerful film. It's a film that really speaks to me on an emotional level in a way that Gerald's Game never does. Now, Gerald's Game upsets me on an emotional level in a way it never does. It upsets me maybe once or twice. It doesn't, like, give me a feeling of continued, like, deep unrest and legitimately being upset for quite a while the way Gerald's Game does. But I like what it is so much more. It makes me feel warm and fuzzy in ways that Gerald's Game doesn't want to, obviously. It's not that story.
Yeah.
And that's okay. I just prefer it. But I get what you're saying, that Gerald's Game is decidedly more frightening.
Well, and when I make the claim that I make, I do have to, you know, bracket it by saying it is absolutely my subjective opinion.
And
there are reasons why.
Yeah, we're getting into personal experience, wheelhousey type stuff that is always going to shift your perspective of a film. But I'm with Arthur that the choice to, number one, I think the Moonlight Man being a real person and being a real serial killer and serial rapist, is he a serial rapist? What do we,
he's a serial
necrophilia.
Well, he does get into live rape also.
Does he?
In the novel, yeah.
Okay, I couldn't remember in the movie. Again, I think the choice to have him end up being a real person at all, huge mistake. It's dumb. It dulls the point. The whole point of this movie is, for me, the everyday, you know, banality of evil, misogyny that Jesse's been subjected to. You know, the things that everyone has happened to them. Everyone has a story similar to Jesse's, or not everyone, but everyone knows somebody that's got a story similar to Jesse's. But with the Moonlight Man, it takes it to a heightened level that I feel like really fucks up the stakes in a way that I don't appreciate. It mystifies the stakes in a way that doesn't work for me.
I mean, I totally understand where you're coming
from. The life or death scenario is already there from starvation or dog.
Right.
We don't also need a potential serial killer.
The thing that I guess that King is working in the novel is that sort of interconnectivity of the sort of fictional universe and the fictional multiverse that sort of touches Stephen King's It, also touches Dolores Claiborne. Yeah. There's a big connection with the eclipse that's going on in that novel and film as is.
The woman that she sees during the eclipse when she references seeing a woman in the well, that's Dolores.
Well, that's super interesting.
So there's some massive connections that are going on there. And what King tends to do is this weird thing in which there are these banal sort of evils that are going on, as well as the true evil supernatural big bads.
Yeah, and these things are often metaphors for the same thing.
Right.
I guess
the film kind of loses a little bit of that, but my sort of prior knowledge.
Well, and I can see what the idea going for is, right? This power dynamic, you know, this power through control, through intimidation, through subjugation that is visited upon Jesse by her father, by Gerald, and potentially by the Moonlight Man, all stem from the same place, right? So I get that idea. They're all escalations, with Gerald's probably being the most benign. And they're all escalations up to a certain point. But for me, the escalation all the way up to the realm of a real Ed Gein type, it just doesn't work for me. I think it's a bridge too far.
I think for me it's just a presentation thing, because it becomes almost as like this list of things that we're hitting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, then there's no real development within any of it. And it's a structural thing, really. I will say, though, one of the most visceral scares, not like the kind of disturbing psychological trauma, the most visceral scare for me is when the Moonlight Man breaks those cuffs in the end, when they're in the courthouse. When he pops those cuffs.
That is really cool. Yeah, it's a cool moment. Yeah. And I like that she gets to, you know, have this moment of facing her fear. Like, I like that for her as a character. And again, yeah, the cinematic image of him showing that he cannot be held. The evil that is him cannot be contained by a court because it's bigger than him.
Yeah.
I agree. That is a really cool moment. But having him fully lit, the effect that they have used to make him a little bit more ethereal, very much doesn't work in full daylight.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, there you go on the conversation about this as adaptations for the year. Let's move on. Let's softball into some of the icky. I guess we'll just let's talk a little bit about S&M, and let's just ask the question, because this is a very, very particular sort of depiction representation of the use of bondage in sex acts. Is this film sex positive in that sense? I mean, that's the first thing we want to talk. I mean, you know, again, just sort of softball into that weird conversation. It does make it look like if people like to tie each other up, that somebody's got to be a monster.
Well, and I feel like that's the problem that you know, depiction of non-vanilla sex often has in film, right? It's usually used as a tool to tell you that some character has something fucked up about them, man, and they're into some... That's not that weird. That is not that weird. What Gerald is into is, I mean, pretty baseline.
Right. Well, now, when he gets into rape fantasy territory, there's another line there, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's, again, honestly, in terms of, like, weird things for people to be into, like, it's still pretty common. You know, it's not getting into the super specific, I guess I should say. Now, where things are dicey is the fact that Jesse does not seem to be party to this at all. And that is a huge problem.
Although in the film, it does seem that she is willing to... Okay, we'll give this a shot.
She's willing to give the handcuffs a try, for sure.
Okay, fine, let's play.
But I guess that's my point, is that these types of relationships, when enacted in a healthy, real-world way, are all about consent. Are all about trusting somebody enough to be like, all right, I'm going to let you tie me up to some shit because I know that I can trust you. And you never get that positivity to those sorts of acts in mainstream film. You just don't. Right. I mean, the only one that I can think of is a film that I think we've all seen, but I know we haven't talked about on the show because it's too good, The Duke of Burgundy. I can't think of the filmmaker's name, but his follow-up to Barbarian Sound Studio.
Peter Strickland,
thank you. Duke of Burgundy, I think, does a really good job of that, but that's not a mainstream film. You know, it's a weird little, tiny, almost bordering on art film.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Arthur, I thought you were about to jump in. But again, I guess that's my point, is that's the only example I can think of there being any positivity to that sort of depiction.
Yeah.
So I would go as far as to say that it's not sex positive because it does potentially dip its toe. I said all that to say it's a little kink shamey.
Yeah, I mean that's kind of what I thought too. You know, it's definitely an interesting way to get into the situation.
Yeah,
and it's an interesting way to create villainy and those kind of things, because you can talk about psychological motivations, but the sort of continued representation in such a way that those who do those kinds of things are the people who are scary. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm like,
have a deep secret lurking.
And I wonder in this film if it's just not a trapping of that plot device. Because, I mean, I feel like that's just one of those things you're just sitting there like, you know, it'd be an interesting story. And then it's like, how do we go from there?
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right, Arthur.
I think that's probably more likely the case. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think anything, I should clarify, I don't think it's intentional. I think you're right. I think it is more a fixture of the idea of the story. What if somebody got stuck handcuffed to a bed?
Yeah.
Was probably the first thought.
Yeah.
And then everything else was built out from there.
The whole thing is a lot tamer in juxtaposition with the book.
That's
right?
Nice.
Right, because, I mean, it's a lot more forceful in the book, and she's a lot more forceful. You know, she bites his lip here, and he gets really stressed out.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, she kicks him in the crotch and the stomach.
It's a full confrontation physically. Yeah. And that's nice, because I don't think it needs to go to that level that early.
No.
I'm glad it didn't.
And I think this is a good place to move into. We're going to start talking about abuse and trauma and rape. So, you know, dig out, get the fuck out of here. I don't want you to have to listen. That's not okay. If you don't want to listen to it, I don't want you to listen to it.
Trigger, warning.
We will still be as delicate as we can be, but we got to talk about that because that's what the film's about. So I want to go ahead and bring to the table before we get into specificities. We're three guys here talking about this, and normally that's usually a problem, and I mean, it's going to be a problem. We're going to do our best to navigate it. I think it is interesting that the film does things in a way that's not completely tasteless, and most of the creative decisions were made by dudes, all the way from the source material to production. I'm going to have to do some research on Flanagan's writing team. I don't know if his wife wrote this one with him like she did with Hush, or his partner. I don't know if they're married, but... I feel like, all things being equal, it could have been a whole hell of a lot worse considering it was written directed by a dude based on a novel by a dude.
I do know that Stephen King did dedicate this novel to several women in his life, first and foremost with his wife, Tabitha, who's also a novelist in her own right, with not nearly the same level of success. And from what I have read, and of course I don't know, women feel like Tabitha's voice must be in here somehow, whether or not she wrote sections of it or not. I doubt that seriously, but I'm certain there were conversations had. And so there is a sensitivity that is applied to the subject matter that only a woman or a victim of abuse would sort of understand, I think. And so that's powerful. And so, I mean, golly, I don't even know where to begin and how to sort of begin to unpeel this onion, which, again, will probably make people cry. So how do you do this kind of stuff? But I guess we can start with just simply the idea of lies and the ways in which we keep secrets and the ways in which they sort of return in film. This is a thing that happens all the time. And so it does take trauma in order for someone to engage that.
Well, and it's... it's something Stephen King does a lot, right? It's why he's kind of the dark coin to Steven Spielberg. King is much more interested in the terrors of youth, whereas obviously Spielberg's interested in the marvels and the wonder of childhood. Stephen King is much more plugged into childhood as the time that you're most vulnerable and the time that people can hurt you the easiest and the times that are easiest to forget. And cause you long-term psychological harm.
And the supernatural horrors never equal the true life horrors.
Exactly. And I guess for me, that's part of the problem I have with the third act, is it gets supernatural. And King's whole thing is, no, the terrors in these novels are the terrors that are just extensions of things that do happen every day. And I think that's what makes him effective as a horror writer, is he's empathy, right? Yeah. And say what you will about Stephen King, but, you know, because not everything he writes is on the same par. Not all of the films adapted from his work are on the same par.
Yeah, that's a very mixed bag.
But if anything, he definitely seems to be somebody that cares about the characters that he's hurting. I find that to be true in his adaptations. Again, I've read a handful of Stephen King things, not nearly as much as Arthur or Dustin. But at least the film presentations do seem to be very empathetic. And I appreciate that, because if it wasn't for that, this kind of stuff that's visited upon the viewer and the character would be a lot more unsettling and a lot less palatable.
Absolutely, absolutely. I will say this, and I've been trying to figure my way into this part of the conversation all night.
Yeah, I think we all have.
That's fair. And if you've listened to the It Follows episode, you will know that I am also a victim of sexual abuse. And one thing that is very, very true is the way in which you do package away certain sections of your life and to compartmentalize those sort of things. And that's sort of what Jessie has done, and she's pursued success. In the novel, it talks a lot more about her choosing wealth over happiness and family. It's sort of a major theme that's going on there. In the film, it's a little bit more leaned down, and I think for good reason, where it is simply that she's just compartmentalized this sexual abuse at the hands of her father. It is not the same as in the novel, which is worse. It is the full thing.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
In the film, she is her dad requests that at 12 or 13 years of old, her to sit on her lap, and they're watching the clips together, and he masturbates while she looks away, and then insists that she looks away while he sees it, which is absolutely 100% sexual abuse.
Yeah,
absolutely.
No, it's bad. It's real bad.
Absolutely 100% sexual abuse. However, it is not as bad as the thing that happens in the book.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And as bad as other things. That being said, it's horrible, and I'm not trying to, again, we're not going to play the game of my suffering's worse than your suffering and, you know, that kind of thing, which is a conversation that sometimes happens when we start talking about species of abuse, right, which is not okay.
Everybody's trauma is valid.
What ends up occurring are one of two things, and this is just the thoughts I've been trying to put together and thinking about this. There is the spiritual practice in which one does something to focus one's body, to alter one's state, in which one must encounter these sort of things. And what we have Jesse going through is something of a forced vision quest. It's something of a forced fast. Right. And so that's part of what's going on there. And also the use of particular images and imageries. right, with the use of the eclipse, that she has been living her whole life in that red world of the eclipse. Without, she's never left that place.
Well, right. Yeah, and I mean, her imagination of herself says as much to her. Is you are still that girl at that lake. To me, the moment that's much more upsetting is the moment afterwards, the moment of the lie, and her realizing in hindsight just how gaslighted she got into, how manipulated she was into the lie.
Yeah,
which is. An even, I don't, I struggle to say an even deeper violation, but an I guess I'll clarify and say an equally evil violation.
Yeah, but I mean, it does also tack on to a really big truism because mm-hmm, when he speaks again of what he has done after they've negotiated how they're going to cover this up and not tell mom, he looks away at the truth because in these situations, probably for victimizers as much as victims, lies are so much easier. Lies are so much easier than the truth. And there's a reason why folks live in those red worlds. There's a reason why people remain in those spots. It's because they don't want to come out, because it's easier to live in the world of the lie than it is to, you know, do the next thing. I totally understand that.
Yeah. And in a, you know, the last couple of weeks with abuses of power in the American movie machine being at the top of topics of conversation, I think it's perfectly valid to say I don't care to watch any film that addresses these topics that wasn't, you know, helmed by a woman. I think that's perfectly valid.
That's totally fine. No, I totally understand that.
I totally get it. I think it's perfectly valid to say I don't want to see any of this in film. I think that's perfectly valid, too. I think that for... I will say that I know people that it isn't very emotionally cathartic to have these things talked about on film and in stories. Because fiction is powerful, and fiction can help you unpack things and can help you wrestle with things that are hard to wrestle with when you're dealing with them directly. So, yeah, and we talked about this on It Follows, I think, too, just the question of, you know, trauma on screen. Where are lines? And I'm of the opinion you can't set a line other than for yourself. But for culture and for art as a whole, I think it's important for us to be able to stumble through the conversation together, which means there's going to be failures, and we should lambast those failures when they happen, absolutely. I don't think this is one of them. I think it's treated with as much care as the subject matter can be, I feel like.
I think, again, it's a brilliant movie. It's not a movie I'm going to be watching again.
No, it's not a fun watch. It's unpleasant. You know. And we're not even, we haven't even gotten to the gross part.
Yeah, the degloving and,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, that's real nasty. It's not a pleasant second act, that's for sure.
No, not at all.
But, I don't know, Dustin, Arthur, what are your thoughts? Do you feel like this film tackles this subject matter with, empathy, with care?
For my money, yeah, I think so. Again, I did find it to be cathartic. I did find it to be useful. I found ways in which, I could identify, you know. I certainly know that there are these certain, like, there's this weird way in which those memories sort of try to intrude, and then that you make decisions whether to keep lying to yourself or go ahead and go there. And, like, that's absolutely a thing. And I can, again, if I can advocate for just a moment, I simply want to say, don't live in the red world, guys. It's actually worse there, you know. But if you're not ready to come out yet, that's cool, you know. And so, you know, when the hashtag Me Too thing went down, I was thinking about this and, love that it happened. Right. My Facebook blew up with it. You guys are making faces at me. Women who are victims of sexual harassment or sexual abuse, all did a hashtag Me Too thing in response to sort of the Weinstein stuff that's been going on around Hollywood, and other filmmakers and other powerful Hollywood executives are being outed as monsters,
either through action or inaction.
Right. And so this has been a great thing, but again, a devastatingly, you know, frequent number of women that have gone through this. And all I could think about was how many women there were and how many women there were who couldn't even say so yet. Because I know how long it took me to say so in any sort of public venue. And it's tough, you know, and I get that. And so when I say you need to come out. You really do. But you need to when you're ready. And sometimes it'll take something like this crazy thing in Gerald's Game, right, that might motivate a person. And sometimes it's up to you. And I just, you know, we don't want to make it a situation in which you want to drive people out. We want to let people do their therapy. We want people to do their healing, do their growing at their own pace. And sometimes life in the world will push us, right? But sometimes it won't. But I do feel like it's a sensitive treatment of it. And lastly, in terms of the Me Too thing, dudes, I must say this here. I did not say this anywhere else publicly. I did say publicly how proud I was to hear from every woman who I did hear from who said that. And though they did not need my validation at all, they have my respect. You know, I want to be clear there. Guys, yes, we also can be victims. That was not our time.
Nah.
I just want to say that. And I can, because I feel like I can say that right now. I'm a victim too. You need to shut up. It's not your moment. They need this right now. It's not about us. Okay, I'm done. So, all right, soapbox advocacy ended.
Soapbox is a good place to end it. Arthur, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I'm not going to follow that.
Okay. So
that was beautiful.
I guess the last thing we might want to just talk about a little bit is just this, again, this crazy, crazy third act and the use of voiceover as a device. Because in terms of adaptation, Flanagan makes this brilliant choice. She is talking to the apparitions in the novel, but he just, you know, he makes this brilliant choice by just having just Bruce and just Jesse number two there and takes out several other characters. But then he makes his choice of voiceover. So what do we think about this as adaptation of just using the written word to the visual medium that is film?
I feel like it undercuts the first two acts. I really do. I feel from a structural standpoint, it feels like he's going down a checklist of everything they're trying to get done in this movie and accomplish and answer all these questions. And I think it weakens a lot of what's going on there. And it doesn't feel like it's maybe saying true to itself. And I don't know if it was, you know, they feel the need to try to get everything in. I mean, I feel like there are other ways you kind of work that in more naturally. And it feels forced and it feels... I don't know. It just doesn't feel right insofar as what they're trying to put together. Because you're right, this movie is thriving when we're doing that external dialogue with, you know, Bruce and Jesse too. And it feels like it takes a step back in just about every regard when it moves into this kind of voiceover to try to sum up so much. Because she talks, it's about 6 months worth of stuff that they're trying to sum up, and what should just be maybe a quick epilogue, we've got a full 15, 20, I mean, it may not be that long, but it feels quite a bit longer than anything else. And I think it takes a real step back as far as the adaptation. I think for a movie that's been so smart up to that point and so clever in its storytelling techniques and adaptation techniques, because it's hard to adapt that inner dialogue.
Yeah,
and you're right. It's brilliant, and there are a lot of things as I was reading. I'm like, how are they going to pull this out? How are they going to make this work? You know, and I had heard there were some smart uses of choices being made to pull that out when I'd kind of read some initial thoughts on the movie. But yeah, it just seems. I don't know. I don't like it. I don't think it works at all, and I think it hurts more than it helps anything, and it just.
Yeah, I agree, Arthur, and I think part of what goes on is that they are less faithful in the first two-thirds of the film. Like, they are making artistic choices, they are making media-specific choices to film that are really, really working, and then they have all of this content that they're trying to drop in here at the end, and they get, I guess, slavishly too faithful.
Yeah.
And that's when it gets clunky.
Yeah.
And again, I mean, you know, one of the things people always say, this is a conversation that's been going on since there's been film, right? Is the book better than the movie? Is the movie better than the book? And most people tend to like the books better than the movie. We gave some examples in our gameplay of movies that do supersede the films. But with maybe the exception of Hugo's Les Miserables, it's pretty much, you know, a classic. But it is hard to read. This is a case in which yeah, you're just trying too hard. They should have made a different choice.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care if they have newspaper clippings and over credits. I mean, there are other things they could have done to make it more lean. I mean, they were too faithful.
I honestly would have ended at the car wreck.
Yeah, I would have done. Yeah.
That's where I would cut. I think that's the ending that works.
Yeah, I really feel like I like the stuff about Jesse, like, working with other victims of abuse. Sure. I think that's a nice button. Give me that super happy ending. For me, it is that whole digression into the crimes of the space cowboy / the midnight man. I don't need it. We've got this whole, like, bucket list of all this terrible stuff he did and, you know, reminding you how dire Jesse's situation was. We don't need to be reminded.
And
we
I feel
were
like
just
that's
there.
A whole lot to digest in, like, 5 minutes. Yeah. I feel like that's like a whole movie. Like to try to unpack right there.
Exactly. And we just don't need it. Yeah. And it's I understand the purpose, I think, is to remind you of just how bad it could have been. But she had to deglove her hand to escape starving to death. Yeah, we got it. It was a bad deal. We don't need that. I'm much more interested with how she's processing this than the crimes of this dude who's really his presence is much more shocking. I would have liked to never know for sure whether or not he was real.
Yeah, I do like that little dialectic of whether or not it's a figment of her imagination or there is actually a real world thing that she's sort of like importing stuff into.
Yeah,
that's fun.
I much would have preferred. And again, I think it would have been ridiculous to have like breaking news: local Gray is desecrated. Yeah, we don't. We definitely don't need that. You know, that hand shown to us in any capacity. I think that would have been an even bigger misstep. But it still does feel super out of nowhere. So I think just getting rid of a confirmation on the realness of those moments would have been the smarter call. Because for me, it really detracts from the, you know, the abuse stuff. That's much more rewarding to unpack and wrestle with. And for a film that does such a great job of handling those moments with care in the second act, I really feel like the third act undoes a lot of the work the second act does for me.
Yeah, I agree. I tend to think the third act works better in the novel. Mm-hmm. I think it does work better there.
No, you have more time.
But yeah, but typically though, I do feel this way about Stephen King, that he is much better at beginnings than he is at endings.
That is kind of the common consensus.
Yeah, and so I mean generally say, yeah, that's I'm gonna go ahead and parrot that same refrain there. So yeah, generally saying he's not as good when he's doing the ends of a film. But that being said, I blame it on a lack of courage on the screenwriting team to say, okay, what other bold move can we make? You know, and I mean, I know you're getting to the end of the film, you're getting to the end of the screenplay as you're writing. You want to get done. I mean, I know that feeling. I'm a guy that writes papers academically. I know the desire to have the soggy ending, and just because you want to finish it and get it out of your hands and move it on. But I wish there was a little bit more movement that happened there. So, without any further need for discussion on this film, let's move on to the next section of our show, in which we make a choice, shelf or trash, and then we select our else's or insteads. I'm interested to hear from all of you. Mr. Arthur Gordon, let's say, with a Netflix original film, weird caveat for this particular categorization that we have given.
Well, and we'll have to do this for the whole month, so I guess as opposed to shelving or trashing, we'll just have to say stream or skip.
Yeah.
For the next month.
Yeah, stream or skip. So, Arthur, stream or skip, else or instead?
I may say skip it. I think so. I think there's a lot of, I mean, the performances are great, and I think there's a lot of good to it, but I feel like it just undercuts itself way too many times, and I think there are better, you know, kind of movies out there, and I'm going to say skip it. And instead, I've paired three movies that all feature eclipses in some form.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so I think you have to watch Dolores Claiborne. The eclipse that occurs
I'm there for anything with Jason Lee, so
yeah, the eclipse that occurs in the past is also the same eclipse that occurs in Dolores Claiborne, and there I believe the characters are in two different cities or areas in Maine or whatever, but that's the connection between those two, and so those occur in the same
good stuff
universe. So watch Dolores Claiborne.
Yeah. I've never seen it. I don't really know a whole lot about it. I've tried to stay unspoiled because I'm honestly sold on the cast.
Yeah, Kathy Bates.
Is it good? Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Yeah.
So good stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then I'm going to say Pitch Black.
Nice.
Nice.
I think that's a fun. It's one of I was never really a big Vin Diesel fan in the younger days, and so I think Pitch Black is a fun little action horror thriller. whatever you want to call it. But finally, you've got to end with Little Pet Shop of Horrors. Right?
Yeah.
I know you meant Little Shop of Horrors, yeah. But I like it as Little Pet
Little
Shop,
Pet Shop
of Horrors.
Of Horrors.
Yeah, it's better. It's better. It's way better.
The plant can be a pet.
He is a pet.
So
feed me, Zemo.
Arthur makes a good point. He is a pet.
Indeed. Okay, well, so, Mr. Dalton Stewart, what is your selection? Shelf or Trash, Dreamers, Pass.
When I watch this film the weekend it came out, I really did like it a lot more. And I, on rewatch, I feel like there's a lot less there the second time around. I feel like once I knew all the story beats, I found it much less compelling. I found it much easier to do the dishes while the movie was on than the first time where I was completely engrossed and wrapped into the film. So it's a very soft skip it for me. There is a lot to like. If you're a completionist with the works of Mike Flanagan, or you're a completionist for Stephen King, or a completionist for Carlo Gugino or Bruce Greenwood.
Mm. I mean, those people I'm sure exist.
Yeah. There are two very talented actors who honestly don't get enough lead roles, in my opinion. So that right there is a good enough reason to watch it. If there are actors that you find compelling on screen, or again, King and Flanagan are guys that speak to you, awesome. If not, it's not for you. There are better things out there. What would I recommend? 2017's it. I think the emotional core of the film is a lot stronger, a lot more solid. I also agree that it's not as scary. Gerald's Game is deeply upsetting. It is pretty upsetting. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of implied unpleasantness in that film, too, mm-hmm. to unpack. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I think the beauty of this girl's, all of her friends who are boys are super ready to believe her when something bad happens to her and are ready to be there and just say, what do you need from us?
Yeah.
How can I be of assistance to you? I like those beautiful touches in that film. How can I defend you, my chubby friend, who just literally got knifed? What do you need from me? How can I help you in this moment? This is a beautiful story about friendship, and this is a story about soldiering through trauma alone. And, people got to carry shit on their own too much as it is, in my opinion. Give me a story that's also by Stephen King, but make it about friendship and its ability to overcome pain. Because that's a lot nicer to me, even if it's not as scary. I'd prefer that. Another film about trauma that I really enjoy, this one much more about emotional trauma or being the family member of a victim of trauma, and it's the Jeremy Saulnier film Blue Ruin, which is just a film I absolutely adore. And finally, I mean, if we really want to talk about the horrors that a patriarchal society visits upon women, let's talk about a film from last October, Martyrs. So there you go. There's three things, the three movies that do a lot of the same things as this and probably do it quite a bit better.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Mr. Donald Stewart. I am going to go ahead and say stream. It's a one-time watch, but I'm going to say stream. It is good. Sometimes it's good because it does elicit some of those memories mm-hmm. and it does entice people to leave those red worlds. And that's a good thing when that does occur. It also helps others perhaps have a better understanding of why the lies are so easy.
And that is something that I really found good about the film, is the way it illuminates why people choose to keep things to themselves.
Yeah, and so, I mean, but it's complicated. And I think the particularity and the complication of it all, the complexity is...
there's a lot going on.
Yeah, it is useful. And so what I'm going to recommend is two more one-time watches.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't recommend this as a marathon.
Yeah, it'd be unpleasant.
Because you wouldn't... Yeah, why would you do that? So we'll start off with Compliance. We've already done on the show before.
Oh, God.
It's so good, and
yeah, never need to see that movie again.
Ever again.
No, never again.
And then second or third, Darren Aronofsky's Requiem for a Dream, about drug addiction and this sort of crazy mad spiral.
I don't know that I ever have an urge to watch any Darren Aronofsky movie ever again.
Yeah.
I've seen all of them but Noah and Pi. And frankly, I don't need to revisit any of them.
Yeah, that's probably fair.
And I don't dislike any of them, but...
Yeah, they're one-timers.
Yeah, man.
So, well, there you go. Apparently, I give this selection in honor of a colleague of mine at Oklahoma State who was asked by a student when we were when he was making some teaching moments in one of his classes that he was teaching. I don't know if it's a comp class or a film class. And someone asked, do English majors only like sad things? And so this is my only sad things set of recommendations in honor of you, Wyeth. Thanks, buddy. Anyway, we're going to move on now as this November Netflix November train keeps on.
November.
No Flixbur. Brought to you by Hulu.
Argo Flix yourself.
So we've made a quick audible here. What are we doing next now?
We are going to be doing the Frank Grillo vehicle, the Wheelman, or Wheelman, where Frank Grillo is in a vehicle for the whole movie.
We like single location movies with B actors.
Look, this was too sad. I need to see Frank Grillo be a badass. I need to forget about this.
I hope this is a two-hour existential crisis film.
My understanding is it's very similar to Locke, but with more car chases.
Okay.
So what if instead of Tom Hardy just being stuck behind the wheel of a car on the phone, what if he was also getting to do badass shit while he was behind the wheel of the car? I've heard very good things about this.
I'm in.
I've heard it's the absolute upper tier of this kind of movie and one of the better Netflix productions that has come out so far. So I'm excited about that because Netflix has acquired and produced a lot of genre fare, and apparently this is the first one that really feels like it's got any legs.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad
that's the buzz I've heard anyway.
All right. Yeah, well, I'm glad we're doing that because what I know is this. Even when movies are lots of fun or when they're deeply disturbing, they're always worth a conversation because that's what makes the movies so enjoyable. So you keep watching, we'll keep talking, and we'll see you all next time.
Some people call me the space cowboy, yeah. Some call me the gangster of love. Some people call me Maurice.
Thank you for tuning in to the Good Trash Genre Cast, a production of Good Trash Media. For more sweet Good Trash content, go to goodtrashmedia.com. Our intro is a master mix of a little collaboration between myself and Junkie XL and Hans Zimmer using the Wonder Woman score and some movie clips. And our outro is The Joker by Frank Miller Band. It's a Steve Miller Band. By the Steve Miller Band.
I play my music in the sun. I'm a Joker. I'm a smoker, I'm a midnight toker. I get my loving on.